United States v. Silva, number 17-2030. Counsel are ready. Please enter your appearance.
Good morning, Your Honors and Counsel. John Arcisi, Assistant Federal Public Defender, appearing on behalf of the appellant, Samuel Silva. Your Honors, I'd like to begin today by focusing on the first issue that Mr. Silva has raised, and that is that the district court abused its discretion in failing to give Mr. Silva's proffered instruction that he was a prohibited person under federal firearms law, rather than telling the jury that he was a convicted felon. Now, the key problem here, the critical problem here, is that the district court failed to weigh the available evidentiary alternatives before it. And that's precisely the procedure that the Supreme Court's decision in Old Chief compels. The options before the court here were, one, telling the jury that Mr. Silva was a felon, or two, telling the jury that he was a prohibited person under federal firearms law.
Would that option be available for most people that face that face the predicate about being a convicted felon? I mean, wouldn't this have come up many, many times
in the past?
And it hasn't, so why not?
I don't know why it hasn't come up before. It came up below, and the district court was under Rule 403, and Old Chief was obligated to resolve that, and it failed to here. To the extent that there's a floodgates concern or something about that?
No, not floodgates. I'm just curious why it hadn't been raised before. I mean, I don't see a floodgate. The Republic will stand whichever way it rules. I'm not worried about that at all. I'm just curious why nobody has been concerned about this before. Is it because there really isn't that much difference in a jury's mind between being a prohibited person and a convicted felon?
Your Honor, I don't know. I think there is a significant difference, though, and I think if we look at some of the social science research I cited in the briefs, and I think just common sense as well as the history of the treatment of a felon status at common law, that it's significant, it's important, it's the worst of the crimes. That it defies common sense, I think, to suggest that this is not important and that there really is no reason we need to be telling and instructing juries that the person on trial is a felon or a convicted felon.
Except for the fact that it's an element of the crime and stated as such in the statute.
Well, Your Honor,
why doesn't that make a difference?
I think that 922G provides a status element, right? That there are nine categories of people that Congress has determined should be prohibited from possessing firearms, and that the statute is ultimately agnostic as to which one of those nine a person on trial has met. And I think we know this for a few reasons. First, the penalties are the same, regardless of the category. And that is, incidentally, it's the first thing that Mathis tells us to look for in determining means and elements that need to be proven. The guideline that covers 922G, I think, is really instructive on this.
Are you arguing that because there are alternative statuses that the court should substitute language that isn't in the statute for one of those statuses? Is that your argument?
I think that the statute, Your Honor is right, the statute doesn't contain the words prohibited person. But I think that it is a perfectly adequate recitation of the elements that are listed in 922G 1 through 9.
Can I just ask, at trial, doesn't the judge read the indictment to the jury as part of instructing the jury?
Typically, yes, but the indictments are often redacted or are altered by the time they reach the jury.
Well, no, I understand, but did the indictment in this case contain the words felon, someone who'd been convicted of a felony?
Your Honor, I don't recall off the top of my head. I can double-check prior to reply. It does appear in the instructions. It certainly appears in the elements instruction, and I believe it appears in the indictment, but it may just list convicted for a crime over 1 year. There's no dispute, though, that the judge did instruct the jury at voir dire that Mr. Silva was a felon. It came up in the government's opening, and I believe in the closing as well, and then appears in the stipulation itself, which is read to the jury. The stipulation says that he was convicted of a crime punishable by a term of 1 year. That is a felony. So the words that he was a convicted felon, this term, appeared multiple times throughout the trial.
The reason I was asking about the indictment is my understanding is there's a challenge to the use of reference to convicted felon in the instructions. But if the indictment was already read with the convicted felon in it, I didn't see that as part of the challenge that maybe the indictment had to be changed too.
I understand. I think that if the stipulation that was entered into was the one that Mr. Silva had proposed, it would have changed a few instructions that were ultimately given to the jury. That is, it would have changed the way that the indictment was presented to the jury, and it would have changed probably the elements instruction of the 922G crime, in addition to the language of the stipulation.
Why wouldn't have substituting the words prohibited person have potentially confused the jury? But that wouldn't the court then have to explain what it meant by prohibited person?
I don't think so, because for the very simple reason that juries are presumed to follow the instructions, and the judge is instructing them that under federal firearms law, a person can be prohibited from possessing a firearm. At the date in question, July 2014, Mr. Silva was prohibited from possessing a firearm. That element is deemed, I'll get the language of the stipulation. It wouldn't change the language very much. It would simply then say, this stipulated fact is proven beyond a reasonable doubt and is deemed admitted. The jury is presumed to follow its instructions, and so that element would be satisfied.
Didn't the Supreme Court in Old Chief actually approve the stipulation that the defendant was a convicted felon? In other words, wasn't the problem there that the government wanted to elaborate on what that all meant? And so didn't the court here do exactly what the Supreme Court said would have been permissible in Old Chief?
Sure. And let me turn to that in two ways. The first is that, yes, Old Chief concerned the choice between two evidentiary alternatives. The name and nature of the prior assault causing serious bodily injury crime, felony crime, or a stipulation to the fact the defendant had been convicted of a felony. Right? Courts obviously decide the issues before them. And between those two choices, the court said, telling the jury that the defendant is a convicted felon was the least prejudicial of the equally probative options to satisfy 922G's status element. Now, here, we had two different choices. So the holding in Old Chief doesn't necessarily compel the result. What Old Chief provides, I think, is the analysis that you undertake under Rule 403 when presented with those evidentiary alternatives. And that's what the court didn't do here. And we know that.
Could in Old Chief, the same option have been advanced of just being told, the jury being told that this person was a prohibited person?
Sure. I think that would have been an acceptable option had it been before the court at the time. Obviously, it wasn't, and it simply wasn't litigated in that case. So I don't think Old Chief's holding can be read to compel categorically the denial of the proposed stipulation in this case. And I think the government doesn't really dispute that the district court didn't conduct the 403 analysis. And I think if you look at the court's ruling, it's clear that the judge simply viewed this as a Old Chief applies. We all know Old Chief, and that's the instruction I'm going to give. But again, that holding wasn't dispositive. What Old Chief again provided was the reasoning and also the determination that sound judicial discretion counsels in favor of choosing the less prejudicial of two equally probative evidentiary alternatives.
You're not arguing that the district court's error was failing to have a 403 analysis because the district court did consider it. You're saying that the district court abused its discretion in its 403 conclusion. Is that right?
Yes, I mean, I don't think
that's so on top of the other concerns, we've got this difficulty for you of abuse of discretion standard.
Sure. Abuse of discretion is a high standard. I fully acknowledge that. But I point to Old Chief, which was an abuse of discretion review, and the Supreme Court reversed on those grounds, finding that sound judicial discretion favored choosing the less prejudicial of equally probative alternatives. So I don't think the standard of review is fatal for us in this case. And I guess with respect to the posture of our challenge, it is I don't think the court conducted the proper 403 analysis, but there's nothing to preclude this court from doing so in the first instance.
Didn't the court consider your option and reject it, and wasn't that the equivalent of a 403 analysis?
I don't think it rises to – I don't think this is a case where the court just didn't make explicit its findings, I think, and that they're somehow implicit. I think the court's ruling really turns on a categorical view that the old chief stipulation is what you give in this case, and that it didn't appropriately balance the two. It never said, well, this is more prejudicial or they're not equally probative. It simply said that Old Chief compels the result here. It pointed to this court's jury instructions, which follow Old Chief, and it cited an unpublished decision of this court, the Prieto decision discussed in the briefs, that really wasn't on point or controlling on this point. But I think the court's analysis is essentially Old Chief applies is what we give in this situation. That said, I don't think the posture is ultimately that important because this court can do the 403 balancing in the first instance, even if the district court didn't. And I think, again, this 922G is ultimately a gossip.
Well, counsel, I'm a little confused. I thought your argument was that the court didn't do any 403 analysis, but in the exchange with Judge Ebell, didn't you say that it did, but it went straight to the Old Chief precedent, and that's how it did it? So are you saying that it performed the 403 analysis improperly?
No. I'm sorry if that wasn't clear. What I'm suggesting that the court absolutely considered it didn't just not rule on Mr. Silva's proposal, right? It did rule.
Which was an alternative. I mean, the evidentiary alternatives were presented.
Mm-hmm. But I don't think the court, I don't think the court weighed those evidentiary alternatives under Rule 403. And I think that is error.
Did the court ever cite 403, or did either party cite 403?
Mr. Silva did in his briefing.
Before the district court,
yeah.
So we can assume that the court had that in mind, can't we?
You can, I suppose, but I think that typically, I think when you look at the court's ruling, it's not one of those cases where the court may have conducted the analysis but failed to make its findings explicit. I think it simply viewed Old Chief as the holding in Old Chief as controlling the outcome here, and that's not the analysis or the procedure that Old Chief compels.
But could it also be that it considered the analysis in Old Chief controlling and didn't spell that out? Isn't that possible?
To the extent that I don't think the court's ruling can be read that way, but to the extent it could, then it still would be an abuse of discretion to reach the result it did. With the court's permission, I'd reserve the balance of my time.
Could I just ask one clarifying question on another topic? On the carjacking statute, are you seeking a merits determination as to whether it's a crime of violence at this point?
No, those issues, that issue and the Perry issue on the reasonable doubt instruction are both raised solely for preservation purposes. That issue wasn't raised below, and I acknowledge that it is foreclosed by precedent, and we could only prevail on plain error review.
Thank you.
Sure.
Good morning, Your Honors. Edward Hahn for the United States, the appellees in this matter. May it please the Court. This Court should affirm all of Mr. Silva's convictions because the District Court did not abuse its discretion in its evidentiary rulings or jury instructions. There was plenty of evidence on the felon in possession count charged as count 6 of the indictment, and the District Court did not plainly err by admitting the testimony of Alana Williams, the government's DNA expert, in this case. On the first point, It just cannot be that the district court abused its discretion by following Supreme Court precedent, and as Judge Matheson and Judge Ebel sort of got to in their questioning, holding of that case says very clearly that to refer to a convicted felon as a felon and nothing more is not a violation of Rule 403. And so, to Judge Matheson's point, I think that for the district court to cite Old Chief in its rationale is a sort of a 403 implicit analysis in and of itself. And that case, of course, says that the mere mention of a felony status is not unduly prejudicial.
Well,
to the
counsel, here's one thing that Old Chief said. If an alternative were found to have substantially the same or greater probative value but a lower danger of unfair prejudice, sound judicial discretion would discount the value of that item first and exclude it. If its discounted probative value were substantially outweighed by unfairly prejudicial risk. My understanding of Mr. Arcisi's argument is that it's far from clear, he may go even stronger than that, that the district court even employed this weighing analysis. Is there any indication that the court did that?
Your Honor, I would say that, at least from the record that we have, the district court cites to two kind of explicit reasons when it ruled against Mr. Silva down below, one being the Old Chief case itself, which I would argue includes a 403 analysis, and the second being it intended to follow the circuit's pattern jury instructions, and there's probative value in allowing the jury to follow pattern instructions as well. And so to me, that is sort of an implicit balancing that the court did, although to Your Honor's point, I don't think that they explicitly balanced it exactly the way that Mr. Arcisi proposed it.
Well, let me ask you, why wasn't Mr. Silva's proposal to call him a prohibited person equally probative but less prejudicial than calling him a convicted felon? I mean, isn't that what Old Chief says the court should address?
It is certainly less prejudicial. I concede that felons probably sounds worse to a layperson than prohibited person. I don't think it's equally probative, however. This court has said in a slightly different context that it is kind of confusing for a jury to hear the words prohibited person in a random, without really fleshing out the context. And I think that particularly given kind of a layperson's feeling about gun ownership rights and things of that nature, a juror has the right to know exactly why it is that the government is now going to infringe on that right. So to say that this person is just prohibited from owning a firearm, trust us, we're the government, we're going to say that. That to me is not as probative as saying there's a specific reason why he's not allowed to have it and we are going to prove that to you. And again, the trial indictment that the jury got just said felon, didn't describe anything about the prior felony. There was no mention of the kind of descriptors around his prior convictions, and the jury instructions only talked about just the fact of a felony. And under Old Chief, that is not unduly prejudicial under 403.
If you view what the trial court said, it was doing it in the context of saying that you can say a felony rather than in the context of weighing. Isn't that true from this record? If you look at the context in which the court cited Old Chief, it's quite clear, at least from the briefs, that he's talking about can we mention it at all as opposed to facing it as an issue of balancing.
So is the court's question or that
in essence said that the balancing was implied and the evidence of that was the cite to Old Chief, but isn't that less than clear because of the context in which the judge cited Old Chief?
It is certainly less clear than it could have been and less clear than I would have liked. But I do think that because Mr. Silva raised it at the trial court level, we can assume that the court at least considered that argument and to say in response, no, old chief says that this is okay, I think is a perfectly fine response.
What about a harmless error analysis?
I also would be perfectly okay with that, Your Honor. If this court decides, no, the 403 analysis down below was not sufficient, this court could of course engage in that analysis itself, and of course our position is that it's not unduly prejudicial, meaning that even if the district court didn't engage in the explicit 403 analysis, then that error was ultimately harmless if this court finds that mention of a felony conviction and nothing else is okay.
And it's not unduly prejudicial because?
Because under Old Chief, a mention of a felony without expounding on the details of that felony and just to have it sanitized would not is not unduly prejudicial in terms of kind of inflaming the jury and things of that nature. As for Mr. Silva's second argument on the sufficiency of the evidence of the felon in possession count charged as count six, I have two responses here. I do think that there was sufficient evidence on the ammunition. We have Albuquerque Police Detective Bradley Perry saying that he saw a particular handgun with a magazine in it in the car. We then have Officer Nix saying that handgun...
The magazine in it. But he didn't see bullets. He just saw the magazine.
That's correct, Your Honor. He saw a magazine protruding out from the handgun. Then Detective or Officer Nix said that handgun was the one that he took from the car and that was the one introduced at trial. And then ATF Task Force Officer Derek Wright said that he examined that magazine and found the cartridges loaded in it. So I think taken as a totality, that's certainly sufficient for a juror to be firmly convinced that Mr. Silva was in possession of that ammunition.
There was no identification of that ammunition. That is, the kind of bullets that were in there was never... No detective said, yes, you charged particular brands and kinds of bullets, and we found those in the magazine.
Your Honor, I believe that Task Force Officer Wright did identify the particular cartridges, and it's not contested.
Well, he identified cartridges that he had in evidence, but did he identify that those were the cartridges in the magazine? Those were the cartridges in the magazine.
I believe he said he examined the magazine and that the bullets were from that magazine.
And he identified what the bullets were with the same specificity that the indictment had.
That's correct, and that's not contested by Mr. Silva. And even if there was some type of insufficiency on that ammunition, this is a case where we charged in the conjunctive, we could prove it in the disjunctive, and there's no argument about the firearm itself. And I guess I'll just move on lastly to the admission of the DNA expert's testimony here. It seems like Mr. Silva's argument is hinging mainly on this 13 versus 14 as the samples were loaded into the software. And I think there's plenty of evidence in the record to indicate that that was an isolated error. It had no impact on the outcome. And our expert acknowledged that she made an error. She then went into depth about exactly how she responded to it and exactly why the results were not kind of tainted by that, and even said at trial, had you caught this mistake earlier, what would you have done? What was the question posed to her, and her response was, I would have just crossed out the 13 and put in a 14. And so that the error that Mr. Silva is focusing on had no impact on the reliability of what it is that she was asked to do. And
but
so
you would agree, though, that mislabeling DNA samples is relevant to the reliability of DNA evidence.
I would certainly agree that labeling the DNA properly is an important part of this entire process, but I would point out that the labels on the actual tubes themselves was done properly, And she made that very, very clear. She went through all these kind of quality control measures to ensure that the tubes were lined up properly and only one was opened at a time and so on and so forth. The 13 versus 14 typo came when she was loading that onto the software itself. And so the tubes themselves were labeled properly. The actual DNA was tracked right. It's just the, I don't know what that software is, something like Microsoft Excel, but like on steroids. That the one time that she punched it into there was an error there that then showed itself on the printouts, but the DNA itself was tracked properly.
Was the 13 or 14 denomination on the samples also, or did that just not have those first two numbers at all?
My understanding is that it did have the 13 or 14, but that was actually labeled properly. It was just when she entered it in.
It wasn't just that. It didn't have anything on there about the first two digits. It actually had the proper digits, in your opinion.
That is my recollection, Your Honor. I can double-check that later. But my understanding is that that's how it's labeled. And I guess the most important thing here is that the way that this analysis was set up was such that there's no risk of a false positive coming in for Mr. Silva. There were only two samples here taken. What she calls known samples, in other words, samples taken from people with identities, Mr. Silva's and one of the victims. And if wires got crossed somewhere along that line, the only other outcome that would have happened was that it would have been one of the victim's kind of identities coming back. So there's no risk of a false positive in this case. And so that was sort of the final QC measure that she took. I'm happy to field any more questions from the bench, but otherwise I'll return the remainder of my time.
Thank you, counsel.
Okay, I'll just steal extra. Your Honors, I just have two quick points. Stipulations are evidence, and it's not just the government saying it. It is the defendant admitting it. There is less, more compelling evidence than a defendant admitting an element of the offense. Second, the fact that Old Chief countenanced the use of an instruction that used the term felon when presented with the two evidentiary alternatives before it does not answer the question here when we're talking about two different alternatives. Moreover, Old Chief says that sometimes the name and nature of the felony might be less prejudicial than the term felon itself, right? The possession of short lobsters is the example it gives in that case. And that's an implicit suggestion that there is prejudice attendant in that word, felon. Third, with respect to the evidence about the ammunition, on page 9 of my reply brief, I cited what I think are the insufficiencies in creating the link between the ammunition that was introduced at trial and Mr. Silva. I stand by those. And with that, I would simply ask the court reverse Mr. Silva's convictions. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.